Good evening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the little slideshow there. Unfortunately, I left my screensaver on. So we're going to be considering Nahum this evening in part one of two parts. The second will be in a couple of weeks. And in order to get past the very first phrase in the book, the burden of Nineveh, we need to know a little bit about Nineveh. It's extremely valuable for us to consider some of the background, some of the history. We really need to understand the times and what's going on when these things were written. And this evening, we're going to be looking at Assyria as a nation, a couple of its kings, and of course its capital city of Nineveh. We're also going to look at the relationship between this empire, this Assyrian empire, and God's people in the land of Israel. So when we read God's judgments and when we consider these things that Nahum records for us, it means a lot more to us. We can really understand what and why God says this. We also need to find out a little bit about Nahum. And there are actually very few clues about Nahum himself. So to start then, let's turn to Nahum. Maybe you're already there. And we'll read the first two verses. The burden of Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. God is jealous and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries and he reserveth wrath for his enemies. So we have the burden of Nineveh. So we need to find out a little bit about Nineveh. We have the vision of Nahum. So we need to find out a little bit about Nahum. And then we start right into God being jealous and revengeful. And when we consider the Assyrian nation and some of their dealings with the Israelites, we will see some good reason for God's anger. It's very interesting to see the interaction between the nation of Israel and the Assyrian Empire. That works. This is a diagram, and maybe some of you actually have this insert in your Bible. It's of the kings of this particular time period, and we'll isolate the ones we're talking about. Now, we've got a few passages to turn up from mostly around Kings and Chronicles, looking at the actual events as recorded in Scripture of the interaction between Assyria and Israel. And our first is in 2 Kings chapter 15. Perhaps you can maybe keep an eye up on the slide and look at some of the time frames and some of the names that are involved as we go through these verses. So 2 Kings chapter 15, and we'll start in verse 19. And Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land. And that Pul is actually Tiglath-Pileser III, which you can see on the chart there. Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land. And Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his hand might be with him to confirm the kingdom in his hand. And Menahem exacted the money of Israel, even of all the mighty men of wealth, of each man 50 shekels of silver to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and stayed not there in the land. So there's one interaction, and Menahem had to buy off Tiglath-Pileser III in this instance. So if we stay in 2 Kings chapter 15, and skip down to verse 22. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, began to reign over Israel in Samaria and reigned 2 years. And down to verse 25. But Pekah, the son of Remaliah, a captain of his, conspired against him and smote him in Samaria in the palace of the king's house with Argob and Ariel and with 50 men of the Gileadites, and he killed him and reigned in his room. Now, why do I have those two verses there? It's interesting that Menahem had this association with Assyria. I guess he was like a puppet king. And then he was killed. And if we come over to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, First Chronicles chapter 5 and verses 4 to 6. This is just a genealogy, but it's interesting. Starting at verse 4, the sons of Joel, Shemaiah his son, Gog his son, Shimei his son, Micah his son, Reiah his son, Baal his son, Bera his son, whom Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, carried away captive. He was prince of the Reubenites. So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, carried away Bera, who was prince of the Reubenites. Also in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, down at verse 26. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, who, as we saw before, Pul is Tiglath-Pileser III, stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and he brought them to Hala and Habor and Hera, and to the river Gozan unto this day. So these were the tribes who were on the east side of the river Jordan. And Tiglath-Pileser came and he carried them away in what was the first of a series of three deportations from Israel. The Assyrian conquerors really created kind of a new policy towards the nations that it conquered. And in order to prevent revolts and uprisings by the conquered people, the Assyrians would force the people they conquered to migrate in large numbers to other areas of the empire. This was interesting. Besides guaranteeing the security of an empire built off of conquered people of different cultures and languages, these mass deportations of population turned the region into a melting pot of diverse cultures, religions, and languages. There would have been little cultural contact between the conquered and the conquerors in early Mesopotamian history, but under the Assyrians, the entire area became a vast experiment in cultural mixing. It was the Assyrian monarch Sargon II who first forcefully relocated Hebrews after the conquest of Israel. That's the northern kingdom, of course. And although this was a comparatively mild deportation, it was perfectly in line with Assyrian practices, and it marks really the beginning of the Jewish diaspora. And really, it was a brilliant idea. Spread out the captives, force them to assimilate, lose their culture, and they will adapt or adopt the culture of their environment. And unfortunately for us, it's extremely effective. People always absorb aspects of their environment, which is why there are so many warnings and so strong warnings to us in the Bible to remain separate. Unfortunately, we don't, and we've picked up many things from the culture around us. Continuing on back in 2 Kings, chapter 15 again. Second Kings chapter 15 and down in verse 29. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ijon and Abel-Beth-Maacah and Genoa and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carried them captive to Assyria. So here again we have a second invasion of the land and more captives being carried away. And over the page in my Bible into chapter 16 of 2 Kings and verses 5 down to 10. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elath, Assyria, and drave the Jews from Elath. And the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there unto this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Assyria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people of it captive to Kir and slew Rezin. And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to the workmanship thereof. And then in verse 11, Urijah built the altar. But again, we have more dealings between the Jews, God's people, and the Assyrians. Continuing on into chapter 17 of 2 Kings, verses 1 to 6. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea, the son of Elah, to reign in Samaria over Israel 9 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, a new king now, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and gave him presents. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no present to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land, and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, and carried Israel away into Assyria, and placed them in Hala and in Habor by the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. Those were some names we heard earlier in the first invasion and carrying away. And also in 2 Kings chapter 18 and verses 9 to 11. And it came to pass in the 4th year of King Hezekiah, which was the 7th year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, they took it. Even in the 6th year of Hezekiah, that is the 9th year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. And the king of Assyria did carry away Israel into Assyria and put them in Hala and in Habor by the river Gozan in the cities of the Medes. So this is that same account, of course, of the northern kingdom being carried away. We notice also from this that it is the 4th year of King Hezekiah. When we come down in the same chapter to verse 13, in the 14th year, 10 years later, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. And we have a couple of chapters here and also in Isaiah describing this incident when Sennacherib came against Hezekiah, and we won't get into that in too much detail. Suffice to say that it ended poorly for Sennacherib. 2 Kings chapter 19, and verse 36 and 37. Maybe we'll start at 35. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch his god, that Adrammelech and Sherezer his sons smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon his son reigned in his stead. It's interesting to note that there's about 20 years between verse 36 and 37. So Sennacherib returned to his land, and about 20 years later, he was killed by his sons. Basically, that's a brief summation of the interaction between the Jews and the Assyrians. And I'd just actually like to read a very interesting poem. I think it was first published in 1815, and perhaps you've heard it. It's titled The Destruction of Sennacherib. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold. And the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners at sunset were seen. Like the leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed. And the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. And there lay the steed with his nostrils all wide, but through it there rolled not the breath of his pride. And the foam of his gasping lay white on the turf, as cold as the spray of the rock-beaten surf. And there lay the rider, distorted and pale, with the dew on his brow and the rust on his mail. And the tents were all silent, the banners alone, the lances unlifted, the trumpet unblown. And the windows of Asher are loud in their wail, and the idols are broken in the temple of Baal. And the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. I thought it was an interesting poem. So what about Nineveh and the nation of Assyria? Well, as we continue on in our chart about 50 years or so, we come to Nahum, and there's something interesting that we need to note. The prophet Jonah spoke to Nineveh about 130 or 150 years previous. And at the time that Jonah prophesied, the empire was actually very weak. It was fragmented. It was humble enough to hear the message of Jonah and humble enough to repent, as we, of course, read in Jonah's prophecy. Now, this repentance of Nineveh was relatively short-lived, however, and by the time that Nahum came on the scene, the Assyrian Empire was actually at its peak. It was world dominant at the time. Again, we've highlighted the relevant information. Ashurbanipal is known as the monarch that conquered the most and extended the territory the most in his reign. But he also constructed a massive library, which has actually been found. And from this collection, we really know almost all of what we do know about the history and the area around around in Iraq. This slide shows the extent of the empire around 650 BC. It's greatest extent, and it was also about the time when Nahum prophesied. Around, I think, the best guess is around 655 was when Nahum prophesied. And notice how it extends all the way down into Egypt. That's Nineveh, located on the banks of the Tigris River. This is just a close-up of the area where I think this is actually an archaeological map of where they found stuff. Nineveh being up in the corner. And this is the city of Nineveh. It was about 3 miles wide and about 8 miles long inside the walls. But there were suburbs that extended perhaps 14 miles north and about 20 miles south. When Jonah referred to a three-day walk across Nineveh in Jonah 3:3, for those taking notes, it was no exaggeration. In its prime, Nineveh rivaled Babylon in splendor. There are many artifacts in the British Museum, but this isn't a slideshow, so you can look at them on the internet if you wish. The walls around Nineveh were 100 feet high and wide enough that 3 chariots could ride on top of them side by side. Around the walls were towers that stretched an additional 100 feet above the top of the walls. In addition to this, there was a moat around the city, which was about 150 feet wide and about 60 feet deep. It's said that Nineveh had enough provisions within the city to withstand a 20-year siege. Thus, Nahum's prophecy of the overthrow of this city would seem very, very unlikely indeed to the inhabitants. It was also a city filled with gardens, parks, and even a zoo. The royal palace had an area of almost 100,000 square feet, and its walls were sculptured with scenes of the king's victories. There was 15 main gates into the city with huge stone bulls standing guard at each. So as we noted, the king at the time of Nahum's prophecy was Ashurbanipal. This king completed the campaign into Egypt, which resulted in the fall of Noamon, which we have in Nahum chapter 3, verse 10. Nahum chapter 3, verse 10 says, "Art thou better than populous No?" Other translations render that. Actually, the margin renders it No Ammon in the King James. And other translations actually translate that as Thebes. They just put Thebes straight into the text, which is in Egypt. So it's interesting, as we read this little snippet out of Nahum here in chapter 3, "Art thou better than populous Thebes, that was situate among the rivers, that had the waters round about it, whose rampart was the sea, and her wall was from the sea? Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it was infinite. Put and Lubim were thy helpers. Yet was she carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of all the streets, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains." So Nahum, via God, is really throwing these victories. Verses 8 to 10 describe Assyrian victories, and Nahum is throwing those victories back in Nineveh, in Assyria's teeth, saying, "Are you better than these places which you destroyed?" And of course we know that they weren't. Ashurbanipal extended Assyria's influence further than any of his predecessors, and under his rule, Nineveh became the mightiest city on earth. And according to the records, he was an extremely cruel man. Back to our timeline again, and we have some... did I put the right one on there? I think I did. We have just three more kings after Ashurbanipal before Nahum's prophecy was fulfilled. Two of the sons of Ashurbanipal had brief and ineffective reigns, which is the small gap there between Ashurbanipal and Shinsharishun. He also was a son, or he was Shinsharishkin, I think, was the grandson of Ashurbanipal. He was also known as Esarhaddon II. And during this time period, around 620 to 612 BC, Nabopolassar of Babylon established himself as the king of Babylon and began capturing Assyrian holdings. By 616 BC, he had won complete independence from Assyria for Babylon. And in 614 BC, the Medes, under Cyaxares, captured the city of Ashur and inflicted a brutal massacre on the population. An allegiance was then formed between the Medes and the Babylonians and the Scythians, and the siege of Nineveh began. And the siege lasted 3 months, and it ended, according to the Babylonian Chronicle, when floodwaters breached the walls, allowing the soldiers to enter the city. And it's interesting, this is according to prophecy. Turn back to chapter 1 in Nahum. This is, I guess, about 40 years previous to the actual destruction of Nineveh, was when Nahum prophesied in Nahum 1, verse 8, "But with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies." So it's with remarkable accuracy that this prophecy was fulfilled. Also in chapter 2, verse 6, "The gates of the rivers shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved." And chapter 3, verse 13, Behold, thy people in the midst of thee are women. The gates of thy land shall be set wide open unto thine enemies, and fire shall devour thy bars. They say that the Tigris River had overflowed its banks and eaten away at the walls. And as walls of those ancient times, and we know from Genesis and the, Exodus and the children of Israel in Egypt, that the bricks were made of straw and mud and baked in the sun. And so when you had floodwaters rushing over the bricks, they wouldn't hold up too well. And when the enemy entered the city, the king Sin-shar-ishkin gathered his wives, his children, and all his wealth into the palace, and he set it on fire, and they all died. A few of the Assyrians tried to hold out at Haran and reform the government, but they were defeated in 606 BC by King Nebuchadnezzar at the Battle of Carchemish. The destruction of Nineveh was so complete that when Alexander the Great fought the Battle of Arbela, relatively nearby in 331 BC, he didn't even know that there had been a city there. And we looked at how massive and how extensive this city was, and in a few hundred years, it was as if there had never even been a city there. That was how complete the destruction was. Nahum chapter 1, verse 9. What do you imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. And in chapter 3, verses 11 and 17, thou also shalt be drunken, thou shalt be hid, thou shalt also seek strength because of the enemy. And in verse 17, thy crown are as the locust, and thy captains as the grasshoppers which camp in the hedges in the cold day. But when the sun ariseth, they shall flee away, and their place is not known where they are. It's interesting, the site of Nineveh, the archaeological site of Nineveh, was not discovered until 1842. Today, the site is covered by fields, a water tower for a nearby village, a cemetery, and a local dump. It's interesting to read liberal commentaries from before 1850, because they had problems believing the books of Jonah and Nahum, because there was no Nineveh up until that point. So, Nahum himself. Who is Nahum? The name of this prophet, Nahum, means comfort or consolation. And it is really a shortened form of Nehemiah, which means the comfort of Yah, the comfort of Yahweh. This prophet is only mentioned once in the entire Bible, Nahum 1, verse 1. His name, in a sense, is symbolical of the message of the book, which was intended to comfort and console the oppressed and afflicted people of Judah. He's identified as Nahum the Elkoshite. And some assume that this refers to the name of his father, and that he was actually born in Beth-Abor, which is beyond Jordan. The Chaldee scriptures call him Nahum of Beth-Koshi. Most likely, though, this name refers to the place of his birth. The identification of this town, however, is much disputed. There are four major theories. A 16th century tradition identifies Elkosh with Al-Kush in Iraq, north of the site of Nineveh on the Tigris River. Nestorius, who was the patriarch of Constantinople, mentioned an alleged tomb of Nahum at this site. That's one theory. Jerome, who produced the Latin Vulgate version of the Bible, believed it was in Galilee, at a place called Elkeshi, near Ramah. A third theory says that most conservative scholars believe that Elkosh was a city in southern Judah, later called Es-El-Kisi, which was midway between Jerusalem and Gaza. This would make Nahum a prophet from the southern kingdom, and would probably explain his interest in the triumph of Judah in Nahum chapter 1, verse 15, and also in chapter 2, verse 2. Some have also speculated, as a fourth theory, that the city of Capernaum, which means the village of Nahum, may have been the original site of Elkosh, and that the city was renamed in his honor, was later renamed in the honor of Nahum, the prophet who came from there. Capernaum, however, is in Galilee, and some feel that John chapter 7, verse 52 refutes this view, which says, "Search and see that no prophet shall arise out of Galilee." Ultimately, we really have to admit that the actual location of Elkosh is unknown. Although it seems very likely, based upon the internal evidence from the book of Nahum itself, that this prophet was a resident of Judah. So when was Nahum written? We've already mentioned around 655, and we've got some proof for that. Scholars are able to date the prophecy of Nahum fairly accurately based on three major considerations. Nahum chapter 3, verses 8 to 10, which we read of before, concerning Thebes. The prophet speaks of the fall of that city, the city of Thebes, which was in Upper Egypt, and it is viewed as an event which has already occurred. Nahum speaks of it in the past tense. Thebes fell to the Assyrians in 661 BC. Thus, this prophecy must have been written after that time. Now, also, 10 years after its fall, Thebes had begun to rise again from its ruins to rebuild and to regain its former glory. Now, if Nahum had waited too long after the fall of Thebes, too long after 661, if he was to use that to use Thebes' destruction as a warning, the force of this warning would have been lost. Nineveh might as well assume, well, if Thebes can recover and regain its strength again, well, so can we. And the prophecy would have lost a lot of its power. In Nahum, the fall of Nineveh is viewed as a future occurrence. The city fell in 612 BC when the Babylonians and Medes finally destroyed it. Thus, the prophecy must have been written prior to this event. And the third point is that Nahum speaks of Nineveh as being strong and full of arrogance. This would place the prophecy in the time of Ashurbanipal, as we've looked at Ashurbanipal before, who's the most powerful monarch of Assyria. And it was under Ashurbanipal's successors that the nation declined and fell. It's interesting that Nahum also mentions no king in his introduction. He doesn't say, you know, in the reign of whoever. There's no mention of a king in Nahum. And some believe this leads to the conclusion that there was no king over God's people at the time worthy of mention. And this could have been in the time of Manasseh, when Manasseh was actually carried away into Assyria. So that's some of the evidence for a time, a date when Nahum was written. All of these factors and others seem to point to a time around basically 655 BC. And this would be just a little over four decades from the actual destruction from the fall of Nineveh. So we'll leave it there for now. It's important, I think, that we cover the background to this book, and it really helps us to understand what's going on, to the environment that Nahum lived in, to the society and the environment that he was in when he wrote these words. It helps us to really understand what those words would have meant for the people who heard it, what they would have meant for Nahum himself as he was speaking them, and of course for the Ninevites. And as we mentioned then, we'll continue this study in a couple of weeks.